Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey America, I'm Chad Pagano, former Army sniper, chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education, and an avid lifelong hunter, and you're about to experience the wild game domain from the hunt to the hearth, airing live on heritageradionetwork.org. As usual, I'm here with my co-host, Chris Jeswaldy. How you doing, Chris?
Hey, Chad, how are you?
What's going on?
Same old.
You've been out of the loop a little bit. We missed you.
I missed it, too.
Well, welcome back.
Thank you.
More excitingly, is that a word? Excitingly? I think it is, right? Who cares? More excitingly, we're here with Chef Frank Crispo, owner, chef extraordinaire of the world-famous Crispo Restaurant. How you doing, Chef?
Chad, how you doing? Glad to be here.
Thanks for joining us. I never met Frank before, Chef. I should call him Chef. I have a lot of respect for this man. For a man I never met just through what Chef Chris tells me about you.
Well, coming from him, it's, you know, he's the real deal. So
right, and just to give you a little background here, guys, we're gonna interview Chef here, Chef Frank Crispo. But my man Chris is the hardest working guy I know. Okay, and he's been telling me for 3 weeks now how this man Frank Crispo could work any of us into the ground, and that makes me feel bad. That makes me feel real bad about
myself.
Kind of
makes me feel bad,
right? Because if he's harder working than you, where does that leave me? I have no chance.
He can't even say the word vacation.
Well, yeah, see, I love it. Watch this. Vacation, vacation. I can't wait. I love relaxing. You know, that's my thing, relaxing. I like to relax. But I could appreciate hard work. So just a little background. To correct me if I'm wrong, Frank. All this came off the internet, so I'm sorry if I got something wrong here. But you were raised in northeastern Philadelphia.
Northeast Philly.
So the suburbs.
Yeah, suburbs close to New Hope.
So I'm envisioning, you know, not knowing that neighborhood, but like row houses or...
Yeah, the ranch style houses, ranch. You know, wooded area.
Italian railroads. Neighborhood.
No, not really necessarily. That part where my parents were from was Italian neighborhood. It was in Tacony area of Philadelphia in the northeast near the Tacony-Palmyra Bridge. But where we moved now, there was all just mixed families up there. I'm close to Ben Salem, those areas. Okay. So like Pennsylvania border.
Sure. Okay, so that's so you grew up, it said, you know, working. You started at the age of 12.
Yeah, Italian restaurant. You know, they love you young.
Yeah, I love that.
Washing pots and pans.
And that was your dad's restaurant?
No. My father was a plumber. No, it was a neighborhood spot. A friend of mine from school, his mother worked there as a bookkeeper. And, you know, we finagled our ways in being dishwasher, making $2 an hour, you know, and working an Italian restaurant. So you do everything when you're in those places.
Right. So you worked all the stations, started as a dishwasher.
Oh, started as a dishwasher, clean, you know, everything. And just, you know. I remember working in the summer, working my hours. I worked 100 hours one week, and the owner was so upset because I made $200. And it was all day working, you know. I didn't care because it was just there, so it was...
Right. So, that proves it right there. That was your summer, yeah. Making $2 an hour, 100 hours a week. I love that. So you came up, you know, what I would call, we were talking about before the show, the real world. That's the real restaurant world right there.
Well, yeah, when it's in the 70s, for sure.
Yeah, and getting the job done and making sure the food was right and getting it to the table.
Yeah, it was interesting. It was a different style of food, of course, back then than now, of course. You know, there was things that were done in advance, and, you know, it wasn't really like what we call the plate-to-the-customer type of cuisine. But back in those days in the country, you know, in the suburbs, right. It was probably the better of what was available.
So then, I mean, obviously you liked working in the restaurants, so you decided to go to the Culinary Institute of America.
Yes, it was either that, become a plumber like my father.
Okay.
But I grew up on a heavy side of life where I like to eat, so I felt that better stay where things are close to your heart.
And what was your experience there? I mean, totally different, I would imagine.
At the culinary.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was, I'm a kid from Northeast Philadelphia, right. No exposure to big city life or anything. So I immediately was involved with people from all over the United States, even as parts of the world. And it really opened your eyes up, and as far as tasting food, I was very limited. So I was able to really, look at that and just like a sponge, absorb as much as I could. And in school, it's the same thing. If you work hard and you cross your T's, dot your I's, you just, you learn more.
You're going to open those doors, yeah. Right? The chefs are going to work with you a little more.
Sure.
Absolutely. That's great. And then you... So any of my students out there listening, why don't we take some of Chef's advice here and put into it a little bit? You get what you put into it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So we graduate CIA. You start on...
Start working down in New York City. First I stayed at school for about five to six months as a fellowship in the Escoffier Room, which was the last class before graduation at that time.
Right, and so you worked directly with a chef for a chef.
Yeah, two chefs. So it was Claude Guermont and Leon Danens. But I also washed, before I finished school, I was always washing pots and pans in the Escoffier Room, lunch and dinner. And that was an experience because we had one of the last people who trained under Escoffier, which was Eugene Bernard. He was a Normandy chef. This guy was a prisoner of war survivor. He had hands the big as a baseball mitt. He used to call his finger, when he used to do fly fishing, he used to say his thumbnail was his cutting board.
See, that's what we need, more real men. What happened to these guys?
This was the reality check before you left school. It wasn't that he was against everything, but he was, again, a chef from the industry of working in cuisine, like hard in restaurants.
Right.
And so when students would arrive at his class, he would expect that they had knowledge building up to his class. And he was disappointed when they were making puff pastry. They didn't know how, you'd make a flour well in the center and put the water and so on in the center. He'd say, okay, start to make puff pastry. And then next thing you start to make the dough before you fold in the butter, and they would fold one side and all the wood would run out.
Yeah.
And then that's all he needed to. He went on a tyrant, and then he showed you how to make puff pastry in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And he was great. Every class he did the same thing. It was like, I sat there as a pot washer, okay, here it goes, and then he just went off.
Yeah.
But he was great because he made people think, hey, you're not ready. You got to get ready.
Right, and there's something about that. I'm a chef, and Chef Chris and I are both instructors, and sometimes you just see it in some of the students. They're not ready, and it's scary for us. First of all, it's going to reflect on us, but second of all, I like my students. I want them to succeed.
It's not their fault. They got to go out and get that raw experience of working in the place before they further. If they say, "Geez, I'm going to go to culinary school, I'm going to become a great chef," yeah, it might happen.
Right.
But, it's going to happen better if you get some raw experience when you're out there seeing what's expected of you. That hollering, that screaming, that picking up, that rushing,
Yep. And it happened to all of us to some extent. When I was an Army Ranger. You guys would both beat me down. I'm not saying I'm a tough guy, but I'm mentally strong. You can't hurt me mentally. I'll stand on my feet all day, sleep under the table.
Yeah.
My first day in a pastry kitchen, I didn't think I was going to make it in the industry. I said, are you kidding me? I was an Army Ranger, but I can't be a pastry cook? This is ridiculous. But you know what I did? I got back to work the next day, and it got slightly easier.
Absolutely.
I was okay. 3 weeks into it, I was running the show. So you got to stick with it. You got to be able to, work through those rough periods.
Yeah, and those things are about getting your dexterity, your hands working close, and really working fast.
Right.
How you work, it's not only like you learn the recipe, it's how you work to prepare to do your mise en place, what your knife skills are like.
Right.
Because you always have those moments where you do cut yourself if you're not careful.
Sure. All right, so I'm probably skipping a little bit here. You could fill me in, but you worked with a guy named, Charles Palmer, a guy named
Charles. Oh, Charlie, yeah, it was funny. Well, I first worked with Charlie. He was a fellowship at the culinary when I was a pot washer. He graduated like four blocks before me. And he and I had a huge experience of getting to know each other. Charlie was a big farm boy. He used to come down and eat like three times a day when you're only allowed two. And he would he would come down to Chef Dana's classes in his bibs and overalls.
Right.
And we met each other. We really hit it off. And he went to, after he finished his fellowship, he went down to La Côte Basque, and I soon followed after him.
And I understand you know another instructor we work with, Chef Mike Handel, was sure. at the time
Michael
there.
Oh, Mike. Yeah, now there's another hard worker.
Right. No, he's salt of the earth as far as I'm concerned.
Mike's he crosses his T's and dots his I's every day.
Yeah, great chef. Yeah, another great chef. Yes. And then I guess Rick Moonen was
Rick
involved
Moonen,
in
absolutely.
This.
Absolutely. Rick Moonen was a fellowship as well. He worked under that French chef called Eugene Bernard. They used to call him Boom Boom Bernard.
That's great. Now listen, I was reading your bio and I like this line. Frank soon became part of the kind of an underground chef with a butcher knife in one hand and a monkey wrench on the other. Explain that to me a little bit.
I guess what they describe me, you know, when you grow up in a family that we didn't have a lot of money and you know, to get things done, we had either figure out a way to fix it or buy it broken, you know. But we always were working with our hands. My father was a plumber, and so we've always been kind of handy as far as, you know, that Saturday night breakdown, you know. And I think I just was just part of that. And so consulting in restaurants for a little bit when I was underground sort of hit some, you know, issues dealing with restaurants when I was early on in this city in the 80s. I just became very handy and started designing kitchens and working with different chefs and just figuring out, you know, what they wanted. And we used to do custom work but just little pieces. And then Chris and I, we hooked up at the infamous Tonic restaurant.
Okay, so you met Chris. Chris, did you know him from the CIA? Also?
Not from the CIA, no. Oh. But he worked with the same group, Drew Nierpoint, down in my Marriott restaurant group. Chef was Chris was the chef at Montrachet, which is, you know about that.
Right? Absolutely.
You don't have to.
The funny thing was I called Frank up and asked him advice about going to the Tonic, and I had no idea he knew the owner. And when I told him I was going there, I heard silence. I knew I made a mistake two years in advance.
Okay.
Well, it's not really so much a mistake. You just got to, you know, it's compatibility. That's what it boils down to. And you know, everybody will tell you in our business what they're, you know, great. They'll just be your best buddy. But you must know the real deal. You know, when they don't disclose who they really are, it's terrible for a chef because he thinks that happened to me many a time. So, you know, just that's the problem we face is that we think we're going into something.
You know what? I always associate it with the military, being in the kitchen. You could talk a good game all you want. You'd be the nicest guy in the world. We test each other, you know. But what do you like in combat? Mm-hmm. When you get out there and the bullets start flying, that's service. I'm sorry. On a Friday night, a Saturday night, when it hits the fan, that's when we know a chef.
But I think in our case, you know, what we always found is the camaraderie amongst ourselves is really lending a hand, you know. Forget about the cooking techniques, but just as, you know, like, hey, advice, what we're going to do. You think this is, what do you think about this person? As a matter of fact, we opened up a restaurant, Charlie Palmer, Rick Moon and I, myself, we opened up a CC Club.
Right.
Which was a Chef's Cuisiniers Club back in 1990.
Right. That's what my notes say. Yeah. I got that. Yeah. Okay. And you basically ground floor up. You designed the kitchen.
Yeah, it was just, you know, what we wanted the place, we wanted the, you know, it was a place basically where we could all hang our hats. We came up with the idea because it was a Super Bowl Sunday and when the only thing that was open that we went to Rusty Staub's and they were serving those Weaver chicken legs, you know, frozen.
Right.
And we said, there's got to be a place, you know.
Got to do better than this.
And so we opened up this place and it was interesting. We had so much press and bad press at the same time. You know,
right.
People were like saying, "How can you guys open up a restaurant for chefs?" We just wanted a place where you can, you know, drink and, you know, be easygoing,
right? Kind of club-like atmosphere.
Yeah, but you know what happens? You know, with the press, they push you to become something that you're not.
Well, yeah, if you're not opening it up to everyone, or if you're not, you know, part of the scene.
Well, we had Halloween parties. We had, you know, everything was dressed up. I was dressed as Aunt Jemima. It was crazy. But I got to tell you, the fellows who took that type of concept and they did a better job than us. I think it was the next level, which was the Blue Ribbon fellows. You know, they really they took it and they became that restaurant dedicated to chefs, and that's really, you know.
Now, so that what happened with that? That kind of just went away? Or
well, yeah, like, you know, I after 2.5 years or so being involved, we split up in the restaurant. I went my own way. Charlie continued on, but the concept is no concept. There's no chefs involved. You know, right. It just becomes a name.
And then did that lead to Crispo's?
No, I was still doing consulting, building kitchens, and I went from I opened up the Bowery Bar for those guys, the club, which was a huge experience. Shea Asada, I did work at Il Cantinori, Bar 6, just, you know, all over the place. Initially we started off with a bunch of friends to open up Crispo, and it started that way. But again, you know, they don't reveal who they are.
Right.
So, but things changed. But anyhow, I pursued it, and unfortunately we were building it during 9/11.
Right.
And we had a couple hiccups then.
You know what? Let's hold it right there because we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, let's pick up right there and talk about the idea, the development, how you kind of started that whole thing. And then, you know, the problems you ran into, obviously, with 9/11,
oh, sure,
and that tragedy and everything. So we'll be right back on the Wild Game Domain on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
You're listening to Southern Pretender by Four Lincolns.
Clear the halls, this is something I've been through before. Not again. If our lives depend on it, so political and analytical, intellectual, ineffectual. It's Southern Pretender, sister, mother, hide your children, ain't your jewelry under the pillow. Sleep on it, from man in the white shoes.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years, so it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Hey, welcome back. I'm your host, Chad Pagano, and you're listening to the Wild Game Domain. I'm joined by my co-host, Chris Gesualdi, and of course, the infamous Chef Frank Crispo here. And we're talking about his rise through the industry, through what sounds like so far hard work, toil, dedication, and really, love of food. How's that sound, Chef?
Not too bad, you know.
I hate to make it sound so goofy, but I can hear it in your voice. You seem like the real deal. I hear a lot of chefs talk, and they want to throw a lot of fancy terms or words around. You know, I'm getting this feeling that you're about the food.
Well, you know, I grew up in a family, where it was God bless him, he can eat. So, you know,
I think all three of us did. Yeah, you know, with our last names.
So when you have, that's what it's about. Opening Crispo was interesting. We started with initially three of us. And, I think that one of the things I learned is that my lawyer who was a great lawyer, his name was Bill Dockery. His brother was John Dockery of the New York Jets.
Wow.
And he always said to me, and he pushed me, but I just didn't do it, which was, you must have a partnership agreement before you go forward, because right, that sets the ground for everything. You
sure.
If you don't like the way I comb my hair, you can put it in the agreement. Right. Listen, you have to comb your hair. And if I sign it, then I agree with
that. But guys from Northeast and Philly generally don't do that kind of stuff, right? You shake hands.
Well, I felt that, I know these guys and... But he was so right. When it really comes down to the nitty-gritty, you have to have. It's just, it saves a lot of that, that's real important. So a shareholder, it's agreement. Before you start putting the bank accounts on paper and, getting the fingerprints for the liquor authority,
right,
get all that out of the way. You save yourself a lot of headache, and then you can go forward with the clean build. With me, it was not that. We had a breakup in the midst of building, and it was just It was just stupid. So what happened, we stopped work, and I stopped. I started going another direction. We had the lease, and they turned around, and they were calling every friend of mine, you know, anybody I knew, trying to sell the lease to someone.
Wow.
It was a great lease. It was only like $2,200 at the time.
And this is at your current location? You've been there forever?
Yeah. So they're calling everybody, and people are calling me up. I said, Frank, what's going on? I said, I don't know. So, you know, I had to finagle and, you know, do things that I needed to do to get them to the table. A friend of mine came and helped out. You know, I got a bridge loan from him, and then other friends came in involved, and so we put it back together. We took them off the plate, and you wouldn't believe it. The first day I get back into the restaurant to work, right, after it was closed, we had a shed on front, it was 9/11.
Right.
And I remember bringing my tools in. I was doing work at another restaurant, just plumbing work for a friend just to help out. And we were bringing our tools in, and some guy off the street just, you know, yells. He says, you know, they just flew a plane into the World Trade Center. I'm looking at the guy. I said, come on.
Right.
But I went out to my truck and turned on the radio. And sure enough, and the rest is sort of history. We were on 14th Street, of course,
right.
And that's the runway to that was the runway to St. Vincent's Hospital, and you know, that was, we were just everything was closed down at that point. It was
right. I was on Spring Street when that happened. Same thing. Someone came in and told us we were in the dungeon, you know, making pastries, mm-hmm. and I threw the guy out of the kitchen. I was like, who cares? I got to make tarts here.
Well, Chris, you were downtown, right?
Yeah, I was in Tribeca.
Yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, a horrible day. But listen, let's get beyond that. So we get it up and running again.
Yeah, we're back in action, you know, getting everything done. You know, the restaurant space was, it was an old restaurant from the 50s. But prior to that, it was a plumbing supply. And it occupied two buildings, the rear yard of one building, our next door, and the restaurant space was on the one we have now, in our leased space, which was number 240 building. And, you know, Chad, when you go through a restaurant, you say to yourself, what can we do? The changes that we made to the layout were far outweighed keeping it the same. You know, relocating an air conditioning unit, which was in the front of the restaurant, it was able to take advantage of the stoops
right
in the front, which jet out into the street like 10 feet. I was able to create a little cafe in the front of the restaurant, sort of. And then moving back, it was had the rear yard. We had an old shed that was there from 1920, and we changed that into a garden, rear garden seating, which we use 12 months out of the year. And we have heat in the winter. I have a radiant heating. And then I have air conditioning, believe it or not, in the sweltering summer months.
Yeah, I got to be honest with you. Chef Chris has been telling me to go to your restaurant for months now, and I've walked by it three times, and the place is packed. And I said, I don't know Frank yet, so I'm not going to walk in.
You
got to
come by, Chad. You got to come by in the afternoon. Forget, you know, if you ever see my scooter out front, I drive one of those three-wheel police scooters.
I've seen it. Yeah.
So that's
how many of those you have now?
No, I got rid of them, Chris. I just have the one.
You had like 18.
18,
though, right?
18, yeah. You know, going
and
through.
How many of those slicers you still have?
I have 54.
54.
So I love this. So you pick this stuff up, you buy it, and you have it.
Yeah. I was buying the hand crank slicers that you see. We use three at the restaurant. All the cured meats. Right. Yeah, we have like a little station. And I was collecting them for years. And I had them in my parents' garage. And then I had to move them up to New York because my mother moved out of the house after my father passed. And so I put them in. I start just displaying them in the backyard. So if you go on the website, you can see, you know. And people always say, what are they, ironing boards? Or what are, you know, I'm like, no, they're meat slicers, you know.
That's awesome. But you know what? We're running out of time quickly here. I want you to talk about the food. What inspires you? What, you know,
well,
talk about your food.
The whole concept of Crispo was, you know, going ahead. I've done these things that, you know, which Chris was inspirational to me. But I seen how laborious it was in the restaurant to sit there and really worry about that one cook coming in and, you know, just like that whole team effort. And, as you get along, you want to say, geez, I want to make it a little bit easier. So I love the casa lingua, you know, that really home style where it's one ingredient. Italian food is more or less about the ingredient, not many ingredients, but the ingredient that you're using. So in other words, it's the best you could possibly have. You taste it, you eat it. You don't have four or five different ingredients. They don't like to mix it up like that. And so I always thought that, you know, if we could really focus, make a place, and I look at it like this, Chad. We try and put everything on one plate with the quality, the price, the portion, and the ambiance. Not expensive. We always position ourselves as a sort of a neighborhood spot, you know. And what I've done is, like, instead of, you know, many restaurants, they fall into this trap of, I got to hire a PR person. Well, I looked at it much different. I said, you know, forget the PR person. Put the money back into the food cost.
Right.
Take it. Allow the customer experience.
Let the customer be the PR person.
And I love the chair to the back. You know, feel your back touching the back, relaxing. And then when you order a bottle of wine, you're not getting whacked so bad that you don't feel, hey, geez, let's get another bottle.
That's
the thing. It's, you know, yeah, of course, everything's got to be in right proportion.
Well, I was talking with Chef Chris on the way over here, and someone was mentioning to me how they had saved, you know, by taking out an ingredient or a technique. I forgot what they said, but they had saved $3 on this one dish they're serving at their restaurant. Mm-hmm. And it's not as good, but I'm saving $3 on it, and people are still buying it. And I thought to myself, that's a big mistake right there, because you know what? They may buy it once. Congratulations, you made $3 on it, but they're not coming back and ordering that again. They're not going to be in your restaurant. So it sounds like, you know, you're doing the right thing by the food and your customers.
We try. You know, we try and use really quality ingredients. You know, we make our own pancetta. We do things of that for the restaurant. But, you know, it's a challenge every day to really meet, you know, especially with the increase in rents these days.
Right.
You know, this formula is only works so much, you know. The new rent, which is, I don't think restaurants like mine, Crispo Restaurant, will be around. You know, they can't. They'll be in, more or less in the city, will be more or less not the chains, but the big groups.
The restaurant groups.
Yeah.
Right. And that's a shame, because then we start losing our way. You know, we start losing our personality, and that's the thing.
Yeah, Crispo Restaurant's like, you know, it's a mom and pop without mom.
That's right, and so everyone, if you're not familiar with the restaurant, first of all, go to their website, crisporestaurant.com, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're at 240 West 14th Street, so if you know the city at all, that's a neighborhood. That they have character in that neighborhood there, and this is a local restaurant, a joint, a place you could go and enjoy and relax and eat.
Joint, I like that.
and you know, a lot of people in New York City, the real New Yorkers, that's what you're looking for. You know, we could all run off to Per Se, you know, but are you comfortable there? The food's great.
Your place is never slow, though, is it?
No. You know, I wouldn't say we're consistent. We're consistent. You know, and we have our ups and downs, like everyone else. I want to say that, you know, we don't stand alone, but, you know, I like my fellow restaurateurs, you know, the guys, you know, I love the camaraderie of the days before, you know, I wish we had more of that.
I love that. Yeah, me too.
Best carbonara in the city.
Well, I was talking to Chef Chris about the carbonara on the way over here. I got to try the carbonara. You know, what you said about the simplicity of food, carbonara fits right into that. You know, you focus on quality ingredients. Yeah. It's not brain surgery.
I mean, when the pasta's, you know, coming off and it's out of the boil, you know, just cooked right, al dente, you know, it really shines. It makes it, you know, the whole thing about it, the twist in it. These are the things we try and stay focused on.
Yeah, that's great. I got to get down there and try it now. I'm hungry. I'm going to go down there right after the show, actually. But, all right, I'm going to put you on the spot. So this is the Wild Game Domain, and we've been here for 28 minutes, and we have not mentioned anything about Wild Game. How about some feelings? Talk to me about Wild Game use, Italian usage. How do we, you know, give me something on Wild Game.
Well, Wild Game, you know, I'll tell you, when I worked at La Côte Basque, it was the old days of sort of the back door.
Nice.
We used to get boxes of fruit boxes, apples, oranges, full of venison.
Right.
And Rashu was an interesting fellow to work with, because he had a lot of top people that were self-starters in the kitchen. And he basically just had to show up in a couple words, but he would never, we kind of like took it upon ourselves to go. So he shows up with venison. So next thing you know, we're doing, you know, we did the classic when, you know, with the venison, the wild venison, you know, not this farm raised stuff.
Right.
And we marinate that red wine, mirepoix, and, you know, just let it soak. And then it'll be just quickly seared, you know, especially the loins and all. And then we'd make the stew, which he used to call shoe. And it was like, for a while, it took me a while to get him. You know, his accent was really, you know, sometimes. But one time, it was before all the Muscovy ducks came in, we had the It's called the Moulard duck. And we got them from Canada. And it was the truck that crossed the border overnight. And we had delivered to the restaurant, I don't know, about 120 cases of duck.
Wow.
Right? And Rashu was like, we just had duck. It was unbelievable. It cooked like a nice piece of steak. Right?
These are whole ducks.
Yeah, we were breaking them down, and you know, the legs were confit. We make sauces, everything. We had just have the cassoulet, of course, and it was just a, you know. So working with it, I applaud it all the time. I wish I can, you know, get more stuff. It's just, you know, a little bit nervous about working, you know.
Sure. These days with government oversight,
yeah,
and people breathing down our backs.
Yeah,
but there's a complete, you know, flavor difference. As a hunter, I can appreciate when I eat, you know, wild venison versus farm raised, and it's night and day.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Completely different.
And you're looking for that. But, you know, sometimes particular tastes, like you grew up with that.
Right.
Today, it's a different world. It's even in my restaurant, we have whole fish delivered. I can't serve the whole fish. You know, I used to do a thing where I'd fillet, I would take the bone out of the fish, but keep it whole.
Right.
So I grill it whole with the head and all, and just have the bone, the center, you know, all the fish bones out, pin bones, everything. And delivered to a customer, I had to take it back, take the head off. They just couldn't eat right. The thing with the head there staring at them.
Yeah, and that's like, a shame that we're starting to lose. That's the best way to serve it.
And we're losing a lot of that stuff because, yep. You know, I used to sell tons of stuff. We could, when I was a kid, we'd sell shad roe in the restaurant. I mean, this time of year, shad roe becoming,
right.
You know,
right
on the menu. Same with the soft shell crabs.
Yep.
Just
well, listen, Frank, it's all the time we have, unfortunately. I just want to thank you. Oh, sorry, Chris, go ahead.
No, I'm good.
Oh, Chef had mentioned, I'm sorry, what was the name of it? I forgot now, our big ending here. The Potato Factory?
Oh, no.
He said you have a big fan of the Potato Factory. Or
well,
said
I don't want, Chris, he does Moonlight. He DJs at Two Potato.
Two Potato. Down all right, so there. You guys could Google that, Two Potato, and look up Chef Chris.
Yeah.
And see what you think of that. Listen, thank you, Frank. You're a man. I hope everything works. I'm going to come in there now a big shot at Crispo,
hey,
right?
Listen, don't worry about it.
I get the corner table. And
you can have any table.
I love that. Thank you. You're a gentleman. It was great talking to you here. That's all the time we have. So thank you for listening today. The Wild Game Domain on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.